This podcast is about equine welfare. It contains references to recent public allegations about the abuse of dressage horses. The participants in this conversation have no personal knowledge as to the truth or falsity of any of these allegations, and nothing in this podcast is intended to comment on or should be interpreted as commenting on the truth or falsity of any allegation. Hello, podcast listeners. Thank you for tuning in today to the Inscape Quest podcast show. I am your host, Trudy Howley. Here I am talking with people about how they engage with their relationships, work, and passions. Please subscribe and share this show with a friend. And thanks to you, we can grow meaningful conversations together, one episode at a time. Welcome to this next episode of the Inscape Quest podcast show. I'm your host, Trudy Howley, and I am wanting to talk to your listeners today about some interesting things that are coming out of the equine community. So I have been a lifelong equestrian. Horses have been a huge part of my life and still are, and I feel very passionately about them, and I am seeking to have a few conversations going forward about different aspects of the equine history, welfare, and importance to us on a broader perspective. The two things that came to my attention these past couple of weeks are, one is a very positive news story coming out of Africa, which has involved a change in the law. The African donkey trade has banned the sale and slaughter of donkeys for their skins. This trade has been lucrative, in particular for the Chinese market, because they have been part of traditional medicine, whereby gelatin has been extracted from these hides. And there is an insatiable demand for these things as part of an anti-aging property in Chinese medicine. So the slaughter of more than 5 million donkeys each year has become really problematic to people in the country whose lives and livelihood are dependent on these working animals to support them and their families and communities. So this change is very important, and very happy to share that news if you haven't already heard it. So the other piece of the equine community news is not so positive. I'm hoping that conversations going forward will actually turn it into a positive, is that in the dressage community, there's been various allegations of abuse and mistreatment of sport horses at private facilities preparing them for competition. I think it's important to address what we could all do differently and what we could all do better, making sure that we don't feel silenced or afraid to speak out, and at the same time being accurate in understanding what might be overdriving, what might be cruelty in the sport horse world. So I'm beginning that conversation here today with Dr. Jay Merriam, and he is a wonderful human being. He has a lot of vision, and he co-founded a unique nonprofit organization called the Equitarian Initiative. And they have spread their work throughout Central and South America, and they work very closely with local vet schools and other education and aid organizations. And their focus is the direct veterinary care provision and training of veterinarians and caregivers and education as it pertains to encouraging a healthy, working equid population. And equid means horses, donkeys, mules. So here I am going to talk to Dr. Jay Merriam. Well, welcome, Dr. Jay Merriam, today. I'm really thrilled to be able to have this conversation with you. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure entirely.
Just to give a little bit of background to listeners who might not know who you are, you have been a veterinarian for how many years?
55 years.
55 years, and you specialize in equine veterinary work. You've also been on the board of the AAP, which is the American Association of Equine Practitioners, and that you started the Animal Welfare Committee.
Yes, the Equine Welfare Committee within the AAP was started. I was the founding chairman of that, and I chaired that for 3 terms.
You're also very innovative and entrepreneurial and an amazing human being. Because you've done some very altruistic work as well, which maybe you could share a little bit about the Equitarian Initiative.
We have started, and I say we, I do this with partners usually, but I started a project in the Dominican Republic 30 years ago for the working horses, donkeys and mules there. And we've expanded it now and changed the name. It's now become the Equitarian Initiative, which is an international group, which I founded through the AAP, which deals mainly with working horses, donkeys, and mules throughout the world. And actually, there are some in the United States who still work and need some attention. But name Equitarian is derived from, obviously, humanitarian. But we are Vets Without Borders, as what some people call us. Our programs have provided training for veterinarians all over the world and still do, and as well as direct care.
Just to quote Melissa Mazan, who's the professor of the large animal internal medicine at Tufts Equine, Tufts University, she described you as a pioneer and a change maker. So I think it's really important that we're able to just sit down today and chat about sort of maybe two different worlds, but also I think there's some crossovers as well, which is the sport horse world and the world of working equids. The reason I was so happy to be able to speak to you was there's two current events that were in my awareness this past week. One of them being some abuse welfare allegations against a rider in Florida who has represented the US and who is a dressage rider. And also was aware of the news that came out of Africa about the ban on donkey hides being, so donkeys were being used for medicinal purposes, is my understanding, and that it wasn't sustainable to keep using their hides. Those two things, I'd love to kind of start there, really. We think, how do you define an equine athlete?
Well, in my world, I had a sport horse practice, if you want to call it that, for 30 years or 40 years in Massachusetts. And, you know, a sport horse is a horse who is used not to produce or deliver goods, but to provide, you know, activity for anything from a child who's doing barrel racing or pony jumping to an adult who is doing a 600-mile Mongolian marathon and everybody in between. And I've worked on and been around those levels of horses all my professional life. So the sport horse part of it is a natural evolution. When our nation stopped moving on horseback in horse wagons, why, there were plenty of horses around and people began to indulge their childhood dreams of having a horse and owning a horse. And now, obviously, it's a huge, huge part of our lives and something that we take great joy in, all of us. I've had many wonderful horses in my life. I try not to prefer one over the other. A horse is a wonderful animal. That's what I think of sport horses. They're an integral part of our economy and our psyche. I think more our psyche than our economy. Ask the parent of any young rider whether it's an economic viability to have a sport horse in the family. It is not.
But they're all certainly a part of our history. If we go back somewhere, there's a horse in that ancestral world because they've been so important in our co-evolution.
Oh, absolutely. My grandfather, who was an inspiration on that side, graduated from West Point in 1904 and was a mounted officer in the United States Army until he retired in 1936. He helped me a lot, just inspired me a lot about my own direction with horses.
So your direction of horses with horses has spanned so many wonderful aspects of your career. As you focus on what's going on with working equids now and the situation that's changed with the donkeys, how do you think that might support your work going forward?
Well, I think that step back just a little bit, 85% of the so-called traction power in Africa by virtue of FAO standards or surveys, rather, 85% of the traction power in Africa comes from hoofed animals, either horses, donkeys, or mules. I mean, it's a huge part of the economy, and they're the biggest continent in the world is moving on horses, donkeys, and mules. So we can't ignore them. They're in every country in the world. These working equids are everywhere. And where we are in the Dominican Republic, for instance, they carry tourists. And when they're not carrying tourists, they're carrying coconuts. Tourism is a huge part of it in some worlds because it's good money or it's decent money. I work in Morocco at the largest equine urgent care facility in the world, the Fez, the American Fonduc in Fez. We see 30 or 40 animals a day from the marketplaces and everything else. And if the animals are sick or die or can't be worked, the family doesn't eat. It's almost that simple. You're right, Trudy. We do have two extremes. We have people in this country debating whether this horse needs this supplement or that supplement. And in the other parts of the world, there are people wondering if we can afford to feed the horse or should we feed the kids. Underneath all of that is my favorite creature in the world, which is the horse.
Thank you for sharing those statistics as well. And so it's a very clear economic need for in many parts of the world to own and utilize an equid. Right. And then also when we look about welfare issues and people may just have this idea of mistreatment happening in poorer countries, there are welfare issues going on in the sport horse world here, right, in the United States in particular. So what's your experience been with dealing with welfare? I know there's issues that have come up with the Tennessee Walkers and quarter horses.
Absolutely. Every breed has had issues, and the issues become relevant as society changes, so do the issues. In this country now, we don't see so much abuse by overwork and bad harnessing and this sort of thing. And what we do see is maltreatment or treatment by people who are not educated properly in terms of caring for these animals, mistreatment. In contrast, when I view the working equid world, I don't see much mistreatment. I see malnutrition. I see the fact that people have to make choices of how they feed or don't feed. I see people starving, trying to support their families with a horse or a donkey or a mule. I see a horse or a donkey or mule as a school bus taking kids to school, thus benefiting the community. I see them carrying kids to the doctors. And then in this country, I see the dramatic positive effect that horses can have on children and adults who have learning disabilities or are disabled in some way or another. The connection is magic. And I think that that's an equally important part of this spectrum, is to look at, and the people who end up showing horses in the dressage ring or the jumper ring or whatever, started off as a wide-eyed kid saying, you know, this is my best friend. And how many lives these horses change just by their being there. You can't put one against the other and say, oh, it's more important you know, to do this or that. These animals cover an entire spectrum of human endeavors, and I think we need to recognize that.
Absolutely. They've been a very important part of my mental well-being throughout my entire life.
Absolutely. And you are able to pass that on to your clients. Yes. And horses, as you and I have worked together with therapeutic riding institutions, I mean, it's magic. And it's very, very therapeutic. And we see veterans with PTSD coming, and it can be miraculous. So, yes.
When we think about the relationship, the harmony, the camaraderie, the well-being effects of human interaction with horses, and then there are personalities that don't really go down that path or maybe started down that path, or that there's some other issue at play. Sure. Oftentimes power and control. Sometimes people can be very charismatic and also very domineering as well. And we see that sometimes showing up in training programs.
Right.
How do you figure out as a veterinarian, what is the welfare line?
That's a complicated question. Yeah. I just, as background, I was the official veterinarian for the Rhode Island SPCA and the Massachusetts SPCAs during my career in New England. And I've been on many, many interventions, let's call them that. At times they felt like a drug raid. Other times it felt like just a quiet talk in the corner. So I've had to help sort the difference between welfare and ignorance, mistreatment and maltreatment, you know, a lot. And it can be a complicated line, but if you keep the horse in the center of your focus, you'll do the right thing.
You've had a lot of experience with this. And for people like me who are not trained veterinarians, what do you recommend that we do in terms of if we're seeing instances of what we consider is crossing the line?
That's a wonderful question, because that instance would be different in Wellington, for instance, than it would be in some little rural town in Minnesota or something else. But the lines, once a knowledgeable, I think the key to this whole thing is knowledge, your own knowledge of the discipline, knowledge of the horse. You can ask the horse, you can talk to the horse, you can see. You watch their ears, you watch their eyes, you watch their nostrils, you watch their stance, you watch how they respond. All of these things that you can acquire this sort of knowledge. There's some wonderful work out there now on pain mentation in horses where researchers, Amy McLean being one dear friend who done research, just looking at the grimace, they call it a grimace, and eyelids and things, you can tell whether a horse is in pain or distress or whether he's pumping out a lot of adrenaline, even if he's just standing there. The key is knowledge.
In that knowledge and education, then there's also responsiveness to that. I mean, I'm aware of many different stories where people have witnessed things that they haven't reported, or they've witnessed things that they have reported, and then there's been no action taken. There is a cultural issue here around fear.
One thing, Trudy, that I think has helped, if you will, is some of these Animal Planet TV shows where they talk about, they follow SPCA officers to places and talk about this sort of thing. That's one extreme. And the rest of it is just getting yourself educated. And yes, big organizations and governments are very slow to respond. They'll look at you when you come in and say, well, we have three horses being abused here and there. And they say, well, we have 200 kids, you know, in welfare situations. And thank you very much. The horses go to the end of the line. So you're better off either approaching through an organization this person might have a part of and need to be part of, you know, and say, well, we'll pull your license, or we'll pull your membership, or we'll do something like that, or let's discuss it is, of course, the first thing. Nowadays, the days of TikTok and Facebook, you know, the video camera is everywhere. If you have evidence on video, it's pretty easy to start a conversation with someone and say, oh, by the way, would you mind explaining what you're doing here? So that the court of public opinion is, in most cases, stronger than the port of any local government or humane organization.
That seems to be important in many different ways. You know, we have to be respectful of how we converse on social media as well, and not necessarily jumping to conclusions. Things may then get handed over to authorities. Images like photographs can get manipulated, though it seems like video seems a bit more reliable. Also, horses are potentially dangerous animals, and we're trying to harmonize them and teach them that they can feel safe with us or feel safe in a certain environment. That doesn't always go so smoothly.
It depends so much on the situation. Some of these racehorse trainers have 200 horses in their barn, or they have four assistant trainers and grooms and jockeys and, you know, helpers doing large numbers. That's a different deal than the one or two person barn or the 10-person barn or 10-horse barn that is being dealt with. It's very much situational. If you get the facts, I find that most of these situations can be handled with the horse as the ultimate beneficiary.
Saying that 99% of us want to enjoy our horses and want them to be well and healthy and happy and relaxed, thinking about the differences in sports like polo and horse racing and jumping, where there's a point system involved in terms of, you know, you knock a jump down and there's points deducted, or you score a goal, or you're first past the post, whereas dressage is more subjective. It's not the only sport that's subjectively marked. Curious, like, what your thoughts are about.
Well, there are a lot of criteria like that, and none of them are the same. And I'll tell you one that comes to mind. I was a veterinarian. I was asked to be the veterinarian on scene for the first winter Aspen snow polo tournament. It was about 15 years ago. And they were trying to recreate the stuff they do at St. Moritz, and polo ponies from all over Florida and North Carolina come up, A, to frozen ground, B, they're going to be working on packed snow. And one of the big issues was horses slipping and sliding around. So they put ice shoes on. And these horses were coming up. There was blood all over the place. Now, that's not a good public relations thing, and it's not a good humane thing to do. We simply changed the shoeing. Farrier and I put our heads together, and we changed the shoeing to ice nails as opposed to ice spikes and grabs, and put ice nails on a Queen Anne plate. There was no more interference. These horses were perfectly fine on packed snow, no more blood. So the perception was so important, because there were articles in the paper saying, oh, I walked to the polo grounds and there was blood on the ground on day one. Well, we made sure that never happened again. The horse was the ultimate beneficiary. But you have to be able to do stuff like that. And yes, you go to polo, from polo to a sport that is very tightly scored, like jumping or dressage, where there's a standard and you adhere to it. That's a totally different thing. And so I know in many instances, they're worried about overchecking these horses that are working in dressage, or the hunters and all of the things. So you have to be prepared to understand what bidding is and what rigs are and what is, before you can start saying there is or is not a welfare issue. But it's pretty obvious that if a horse, and you see this in the reining, or used to in the reining classes, where these horses would come to a big, long sliding stop and then spit a bloody saliva on the ground, and you pull the bit out and it looks like, you know, a medieval torture device. And so that particular discipline, the judge has to actually see the bit at the end of the slide. And so that's a pretty big response to what used to be just a wild, wild west show of the reining was. And I think each discipline needs to go down look back at its history. Dressage, of course, was military movement. My grandfather rode dressage before they knew what it was, you know. But that was a military movement then, was training these horses to get over obstacles and be quiet in the face of a lot of problems. So every discipline has its own markers. And I think before we call foul, we have to know exactly what we're talking about.
Absolutely. I'm curious also, when you think about the breeding of the horses, the horses in the racehorse world are obviously bred for speed. And in dressage, there's so many beautiful horses being bred right now. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about the adult amateur driving the economics of the dressage world, yet there's a lot of horses that are being bred that the adult amateur can't ride.
And you know, the economics is what comes into play here. As you know, Trudy, feeding one horse or feeding 10 horses or supporting them becomes a huge burden. Thus, let's get this thing into the ring as soon as we can. And that's been the bane of the racehorse business, is racing them too young and too hard. And I think I didn't used to see it in the dressage, and the three-day horses were all 5 years and up before they did anything. And the Lipizzaners, you know, are 7 or 8 before they're considered trained. But economics drives us to shorten that window. And I think that puts an awful lot of pressure on the horse. And the young horses can't deal with that. And the long-term effect of that is you get a lot of what I call wastage, where perfectly good young horse that had a lot of potential just isn't given enough time and proper training, and then suddenly he's gone.
And does that put pressure on the equine veterinarians as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely, because they're coming in and saying, you know, I've got a bunch of two-year-olds to have you inject their hocks. I can make a nice new boat payment on something like that, but it's not ethical. It's not appropriate. It goes on every day, and owners get staggering bills for things that trainers perceive necessary, quote unquote, and veterinarians get on the necessary train because it's necessary for me to feed my family and keep that guy as a client. There's an awful lot of pressure on these animals.
Just thinking about going back and forth between the two different worlds for a moment, what can we learn from the working equids and animal behavior and maybe translate that into the sport horse world?
Well, it's wonderful that you'd ask that, because for years when we first started, you know, we were what we call the tip of the spear. We'd go in and say, oh, we have this horrible condition and that horrible condition, and aren't we wonderful? We're veterinarians. We can fix this and we can fix that. But there was still, if you take your time and look at these working equids, what you find was there's an awful lot of background noise. And a lot of these people who own working equids, they don't love them, but they're attached to them in some way. They don't spend a lot of money training them or time. We have found that we can bring, with every team now in Mexico for sure, and usually in Central America, we have a behaviorist come with us, a trainer who is one of these, you know, these horse whisperer type guys. But this guy is the antithesis of that. He doesn't drive a big car or anything else, but he knows his horses. And he trains people. You know, they'll bring a stallion to us and say, oh, we can't handle him, he's crazy. And we give him tomorrow, and 15 minutes he's walking around, following him around. He does, you know, an awful lot of long lining and training with them. And then he, in turn, is teaching the villagers how to do this. And the important thing is that he is a native. He's one of them. He speaks their language, whatever it is. He looks like them. He talks like them. And they say, yeah, well, we can do this too. That's what I bring back to my world, is that there are people out there who can teach you how to do this. I mean, it's not necessarily intuitive, you know, for you to be a good horse handler. You know, you have to learn it. And I think, again, education is absolutely key, and that's part of the education process. He sure educated me.
I love that he's doing that, and also that sort of pay it forward type of program as well, that the community is, you're not just going out there and being charitable and triaging injured working equids, but you're actually educating people how.
And we have an animal scientist, this Amy McLean I've talked to you about. She is a mule and donkey specialist, and she'll go through and look at every bit on the property where we are, and talk to people about bidding and harnessing. And then I've had in the Dominican Republic, I've got a man who goes with me, who's a native, who is that good and can do that. And we're pulling wire out of their mouths and pieces of string, and it's pretty amazing.
It certainly sounds it. What do you think we collectively need to do as a community to keep on making changes? Yeah.
The key, I think, and I keep using the word, but we educate people. We bring this stuff out into the open and say, here's an example of a really well done horse rider combination and the proper equipment. And here's one that looks pretty good, but let's examine it. Oh, this isn't so good. You know, does this horse naturally carry himself like this, or does he have, you know, burn marks on the back of his neck, or has he mouth been all beaten up? I mean, so it's education and being very upfront about it. There's no shortcuts. As I said, my friend Amy has developed what they call an ethogram, where she will stand and look at your horse for a couple of minutes and then tell you an awful lot about how he is feeling and teach you very simple tricks, you know, to get an idea of how they are.
I like that idea as well. That when we're focusing on animal welfare, that we're part of that. You know, I hear so many times, like, my horse won't do this, my horse won't do that. And it's like, what's going on inside of you? You know, what are you bringing to your horse today? Looking at the rider, the owner, the stable manager, the farrier, the veterinarian, like, how are we showing up for them?
Right. I used to talk to the grooms when no one's around. You know, you can get an awful lot of interest, especially if you speak Spanish or whatever language they're in, you can get an awful lot of information that wasn't, say, presented up front about behavior, about how the horse, they said they only jumped him four times, try 200, you know, things like that. Again, it's just getting the information and getting it out there. You've had a lot of success and a lot of fun. It's refreshing when I go to these trips. People say, isn't it discouraging? No, it's not, because you can lift some of these animals up, that, and people too. And it's all about the families. And the same is with our show horses. I mean, families love their horses.
And I think that's important, that those riders and trainers and families, because it really is a team sport. Those people are elevated to be put on teams, and that aggressive training or riding is not necessarily elevated.
Oh, absolutely not. And, you know, I've worked on many, many Olympic dressage horses and a few Olympic jumpers when I was in the New England area. And boy, you know, there are some of these trainers who are just a little bit hard to push. And you have to stand back and say, no, I'm not going to do this, or I'm not going to do that. That's all I can do as a veterinarian. But as a community, we have to say, we don't tolerate this kind of behavior.
Absolutely. And hopefully, just having this conversation today, hopefully people will be a bit more inclined to talk to others about it and feel more comfortable about engaging in a conversation and figuring out, you know, what are the lines here? Are lines being crossed? Do we need to do anything about this, or do we just need to educate somebody who doesn't really understand what better ways there are?
That's exactly right.
Do you have any sort of closing thoughts about people entering the veterinary field in this day and age?
I'm excited. My wife and I are providing a scholarship every year for some third or fourth year student to go to the third world with one of our teams. There's this hospital in Morocco called the Fondouk has been a wonderful teaching place for students. I just encourage students to get out into that world, because it will help them with this world. you'll see conditions that, you know, that you only read about in the third world. You come back home and it'll make you a better doctor. I'm very impressed with the young people I've dealt with, and I still do. My hope is, you know, that's what I had to learn 30 years ago, was that, yeah, these are horses. The problems are the same in many cases. It's not, there's a difference between maltreatment and malnutrition and, you know, just neglect and just raw poverty. And I think having a window into that world, the donkey thing in Africa is horrible. It's just horrible. And again, my friend Amy McLean has been working with them, helping develop the regulations and the sort of thing. So doing the welfare committee, one of our first things was to put on the first equine welfare program at an AAP convention. So with 2,000 people, I had soaring, tail docking, tail swishing, you know, the whole thing, plus racing, plus chariot, you know, and we just laid out a buffet of things we needed to correct. And now 30, 40, 50 years later, those things are still there, but most of them have been worked on pretty aggressively to good effect.
Yeah, it's an honor and a privilege. So thank you for being available today to discuss this. Thank you.
I just want to take a moment to thank you for listening and to express my gratitude for following another episode of the InScape Quest podcast show. If you have any questions about the things we covered in the show or would like to follow my projects, please find me on Instagram and LinkedIn. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred listening platform, and share this episode with your friends. Cheerio for now.